Hello, everyone, and welcome into the Star Wars Legends Lounge, the show that celebrates the books from Star Wars Legends. I'm Aaron Motes. On today's episode, Luke and Jason arrive in Chiss space as they continue their search for the living planet Zonama Sikat. Meanwhile, Namor continues his secret insurrection against Shimra on Yuuzhan Tarr. It's Force Heretic 2, Refugee, by Sean Williams and Shane Dix, book number 16 in the New Jedi Order series. Joining me to talk about the book today is Kat. Welcome back to the show, Kat.
Woo, I'm so excited to be here. I'm excited to talk about this. This book is so great.
Tell the listeners how you've been the last few months. Are you still enjoying your voyage through the New Jedi Order as we get close to the end of the series here, coming up in a few short books?
Yeah, I can't believe that we've made it close to the end already. As Aaron promised, I have been getting some romance here and there, so I'm pretty happy. I do have some things to talk about later on, but I'm loving this series so much, and couldn't be happy to join the Star Wars expert in talking about it.
Well, listener, Kat is the co-host of the Animated Antics podcast. What have you and Jay been up to lately on your podcast, Kat?
Well, we just put out our episode a little bit, two or three weeks ago, on The Dragon Prince. That's on Netflix, also under the name Mystery of Erebos. But that was a super, super fun episode to record. That's like 9 episodes, so give that a listen. And then we're actually going to be watching the first season of Clone Wars next, which I am super pumped about. And have Aaron to thank for my love of that show.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Kat and I are excited to talk about this book, which we will do here in a few minutes. But first, it's listener question time. And we have 2 emails today. Kat, will you please read our first question, which comes from Charlie H.
Charlie says, I really enjoy your outlook on the Star Wars universe and its intricacies. What is your opinion on the legacy of the Force series? No spoilers. Personally, it's my favorite series, and Jason, my favorite character. Do you think there are too many super weapons in Legends? And what piece of Star Wars music is your favorite? Thanks for continuing the podcast, and may the Force be with you.
Well, thank you very much for the email, Charlie. Now, full disclosure, listener, Charlie had one more question on his email, but I'm not going to include it here because I think it's going to spoil something about one of the characters for those who haven't read beyond this New Jedi Order series, which includes 3 of my co-hosts here on the show, Kat, K2, and Scott. So we're not going to include that question. But for your other ones, Charlie, I do like the legacy of the Force series. It's not my favorite, but I do like it a lot more than the Darkness trilogy that comes immediately before Legacy of the Force. I would definitely recommend Legacy of the Force for fans of Jason, Jaina, and Tahiri, if you're a fan of those characters. On to Charlie's second question. Yes, there are too many super weapons in Legends, in my opinion. You got the Galaxy Gun, the Sun Crusher, the Darksaber, Centerpoint Station, the Starforge, Alpha Red from the New Jedi Order just a few books ago. If you include the Death Stars from the original trilogy, that's 8 just off the top of my head. And I'm sure other fans of Legends can think of more. Now for Charlie's third question, Kat, I'll let you go first. What is your favorite piece of Star Wars music?
That is a tough one. I love film score so much. There's obviously something to say about Darth Vader's theme because it just automatically brings chills. But I also love in the final season of Clone Wars when we get the battle between Ahsoka and Darth Maul. That scene is so epic for so many reasons, but it is really amplified by their choice of music in that scene. So that's a big part.
Charlie, I will tell you this is an extremely difficult question because, like when folks ask me what my favorite book is, is kind of fluid. I think it depends on your feelings at the time. There's only a handful of absolutes in Star Wars for me. The Empire Strikes Back is my favorite film. I'm not sure I'm ever going to change my mind on that one. Darth Vader is my favorite character. I don't know if I'll ever change my mind on that one. You may have found one other thing, Charlie, that's an absolute for me. I'm not going to swear to it 100%, but my favorite piece of music in all of Star Wars, it's in A New Hope when Luke walks out of the Lars homestead at dusk and he looks up at the twin suns, sort of wistfully thinking about what he hopes his future will be. And it's the Force theme there as he's looking up in the Twin Suns. I think that is my favorite piece of music in Star Wars.
Great, great pick. That scene is really great and made so much more epic by that music. So, perfectly said.
Today's second email comes from listener Luke, who has a number of questions. So, Kat, let's do this rapid fire style. You ready?
You got it.
All right. The signs in the movies that have the weird text on them, is it a real language that it's based off of? Yes, Luke. Most of those signs are in a language called Aurobesh. It's the written form of the language called Galactic Basic, and Galactic Basic is the Star Wars universe's form of English. Question 2. Who do you think are more powerful, Palpatine's Imperial Red Guards or Snoke's Praetorian Red Guards?
I gotta go with the Praetorian Red Guards. Palpatine didn't even need his Red Guards. He had Darth Vader. So I'm gonna go with the Red Guards. I don't know. Why not? The Praetorian Red Guards.
Kat, I guess I would have to agree with you if we're just talking about the movies, because we never saw the Imperial Red Guards do anything. We did see the Praetorian Guards in The Last Jedi fighting against Kylo Ren and Rey. There is a group of comics in Legends called Crimson Empire. Luke, if you want to see Imperial Guards in action, and I would say if I was going by that, I would take Palpatine's Imperial Red Guards. Question 3. How big is the origin tree from Jedi Fallen Order? Well, Luke, this one's easy. We don't know. Question 4. Who do you think would win a free-for-all between Mace Windu, Darth Maul, Luke Skywalker, Anakin Skywalker, Yoda, Obi-Wan, Rey, and Cal Kestis?
Well, I don't think Anakin could win many fights. Darth Vader, definitely. But Anakin still has a heart. So I'm going to go with Darth Maul because he does not care.
Wow, this is a good one.
It's also very, very difficult.
It is.
All of them.
Maybe Prime Anakin could defeat anyone, but Luke defeated Anakin. And as far as I know, Luke won a different way. He won by throwing his lightsaber down. I don't know if that'll win a free-for-all, because... Well, I just don't know if it'll win a free-for-all, but...
They'd have to be mind-controlled or something to be in this situation.
Maybe. I don't know, but I'm going to take Luke. All right. Luke's final question, Kat. He says, I started year 9 this year in school, and my friend has never seen Star Wars. What could I say that would make him interested enough to attempt watching it?
Well, this one's easy, because that was definitely me at one point. And I had seen the original trilogy and it hadn't done anything one way or the other. I loved it, but I didn't have that same kind of cultural love for it until my good friend Aaron said, please watch this Clone Wars. I am here for any and all questions, and just fall in love with these clones. And he was right. He's right about everything. So listen to this man. But I would definitely start off with something that your friend really likes. If he's really into animation, like I was, start him on Clone Wars. If he really likes the storyline or characters, definitely start him on that original trilogy. You know, it has something for everyone.
I would agree with Kat. Ask your friend what he likes in entertainment, because there are enough things in Star Wars to appeal to people who like a variety of things. Luke, I would go into this, though, knowing that not everyone's going to be interested in it. I have a brother who has just never been interested in Star Wars, and that's perfectly okay. Ask your friend what things they like in a story. Tailor your response to the things they like. It can be a movie. It could be a television show. It could be a video game. It could be a comic book. It could be a book. Star Wars has something for everyone. And all you can do is give them the information. They can decide if they want to give it a shot or not. Thank you very much for the email, Luke. Now, listener, if you've got a question you'd like answered on the show, send me an email at swlegendslounge@gmail.com or send me a tweet at legendslounge1. And stay tuned to the end of today's episode as I read an email from a listener with a different opinion from mine on Mara Jade's character. It's very interesting. But now it's time for today's book, Force Heretic 2, Refugee, by Sean Williams and Shane Dix. Kat, are you ready to go?
Heck yeah, let's do this.
Well, grab yourself a drink. Let's head in to the Star Wars Legends Lounge.
The story begins as our heroes continue their search from Zenoma Sakaat. In the unknown regions, Luke, Mara, Jason, Danny, Saba, and Tekli, along with some Imperial support, speak with the inhabitants of the planet with the Krizlaw, who had an encounter with the living planet. They speak of the disaster the planet brought to their people, but when Luke tries to talk to them about the possible benefits, the Krizlaw attack, killing two stormtroopers, and chase the group back to the Jade Shadow. After they take off from the planet, they are contacted by a Chiss exploratory ship, captained by Commander Irolia. She says they are traveling dangerously close to Chiss territory. When Luke asks permission to travel through the region, Irolia says they'll need to ask permission from the Chiss ruling families.
On Yuuzhan Tar, Namor takes control of the new Jedi religion, moving through the lower castes of the Yuuzhan Vong. Disguised as Yuusha, the prophet, the former executor perfects the heresy against Supreme Overlord Shimra. But the movement can only help Namor's plans to a point. He needs to get eyes inside Shimra's court. During one of the prophet's sermons, he's approached by a shamed one that is different from the rest. Smarter, more motivated. Namor suspects Shimra has sent a spy to kill him. When the shamed one begins to remove her disguise, Namor shoots her with poison, before realizing she's a priestess of Yun Harla and a true believer in the Jedi. He gives her the antidote to the poison and learns that she is N'Gala, who believes Namor to be the true chosen leader for the Yuuzhan Vong. N'Gala agrees to spy on Shimra and help Namor achieve his goal of taking over the Vong.
Meanwhile, Leia, Han, and Jaina arrive at Bakura, following a tip from the Wren they helped on Galantos. The Wren says that Bakura is in the middle of a delicate situation. The Shryuk have been taken over by the Imperium's former slaves, the Puek. The Bakurans have agreed to a truce with the new Shryuk leader, the Kiramek, who has arrived to consecrate the planet. The Bakurans invite the Solos and Tahiri to stay as honored guests and witness the ceremony. But not everyone is a fan of the plan. A Bakuran rebellion, calling themselves Freedom, opposes the truce, and they've been blamed for the disappearance of Prime Minister Kondratol. Leia and Han learn that Freedom is run by Malenza Tanis, the 15-year-old daughter of their former ally, Gariel Captisson. The Bakurans have Malenza in custody, saying she refuses to say where Freedom is holding Kondrotil. Leia asks permission to speak with Malenza. She's initially denied, but eventually the Bakurans give their permission to allow Jaina to visit the young woman in prison.
Back in the unknown regions, the Skywalkers arrive at the Chiss capital planet, Chila, where they meet Jagfell's parents, Soontir and Sile, and his sister, Wyn. At first, the Chiss don't believe Luke. They say Zanama Seacott is a myth, and his group must be looking for a way to bring the Chiss into the war against the Yuuzhan Vong. Eventually, Luke and Jacen convince the Chiss they're only looking for information about the planet, and they're granted 2 days to search through the Chiss library for information. But all of the information is in books. Physical books. How are they going to find the information they're looking for? They work through the night without any luck. The following morning, a rogue group of Chiss tries to kidnap Wyn, hoping to force Soontir and the Chiss leadership to expel Luke and his group from Chiss space. The rogue Chiss grab Wyn and head off through the tunnels below the library, with Jacen and Commander Irolia in hot pursuit.
On Bakura, Jaina enters the prison to speak with Malenza Tanis. The leader of Freedom says they're just a group of peaceful protesters who don't want Bakura to form a partnership with the Shri-Rook. But they don't want the planet to stay in the Galactic Alliance either. Malenza says Freedom wants Bakura to be independent. Jaina sympathizes with the young woman, but says she can't help her unless Malenza tells Jaina where Freedom is holding the Prime Minister. Again, Malenza says Freedom didn't kidnap Kondrotil. She tells Jaina she's being framed. When Jaina turns to leave the cell, she discovers the prison is empty. Jaina and Malenza leave the prison and head to Freedom's headquarters. But it's a trap! The prison guards had put a tracker on Malenza and allowed her to escape so they could track down Freedom.
Back on Chila, Jacen and Irolia catch up with Wyn's abductors just before they board a subterranean hover train. Jacen uses the Force to disarm the Chiss, while Irolia stuns them, rescuing Wyn. At the same time, Mara, Luke, Danny, Saba, and the Fells are attacked on their way to the spaceport. The Jedi quickly defeat the rebels and reunite the Fells with their daughter. To show their gratitude, the Chiss grant Luke extra time to search the archives. But the search proves frustrating. None of the reports of a rogue planet turn up Zanama Seacott. Needing a break, Jacen and Danny talk about their feelings for one another. Danny compares them to satellites in different orbits. "That's it!" Jacen cries. "We've only been looking for rogue planets. But what if Zanama Seacott is hiding as a moon?" Sure enough, they find a report of a distant gas giant that seems to have picked up a moon about a decade ago. "That's it," Jacen says. "That's Zanama Seacott."
As the Bakuran authorities close in on Freedom, Prime Minister Kondrotil appears in orbit in a stolen escape pod. Kondrotil says he was captured by pirates, not Freedom. But Leia and Han don't think the Prime Minister's story adds up. Leia thinks Kondrotil feels off in the Force. Meanwhile, Freedom is betrayed by one of their own, a Rodian named Salkali. He takes Jaina, Malenza, and the leaders of Freedom to the office of Deputy Prime Minister Blaine Harris. It turns out Harris has been secretly funding Freedom and plans to blame the group when he sets off a bomb at the Kiramex consecration ceremony. Harris and Salkali shackle Jaina and the members of Freedom and force them to march through tunnels beneath the amphitheater where the ceremony is taking place. And where Harris starts the timer on the bomb.
As the ceremony begins, Leia and Tahiri feel Jaina's panic through the Force. Something is wrong. Leia heads toward Prime Minister Kondrotil's suite, while Tahiri heads out to find Jaina. Along the way, she's joined by a Wren named Gore. They head under the stadium, find Jaina, free the captives. Jaina tells Tahiri about the bomb. The young Jedi tells Jaina to go warn her mother. She's going to stay and try to stop it. Jaina emerges from under the arena floor and tells Leia about Tahiri and the bomb. Quickly, Leia and Han begin ushering people out of the arena. Jaina tries reaching Tahiri on her comlink, yelling at the girl to get out. Just before the timer strikes zero, Jaina hears a scream. But it doesn't sound like Tahiri. It sounds like Rhyena. Then, the bomb explodes.
Jaina and her parents start helping to dig people out of the rubble. Luckily, the damage wasn't nearly as bad as it could have been. The blast looks as if it was centered beneath the Prime Minister's suite. The Keramech watches the chaos from the stage surrounded by its Puek bodyguards. As the Solos continue to help rescue efforts, the sky darkens, and several Shri Ruri dropships begin to land. It's an invasion. The aliens planned the consecration so they could begin their war against the Bakurans and take their planet for their own.
Jaina finds Tahiri's body beneath the rubble. Remarkably, there's not a scratch on her. The young Jedi must have shielded herself with the Force, just as the bomb exploded. Gore picks up Tahiri's unconscious body and flees with the Solos as the Sai Ruvi and Puek soldiers enter what's left of the arena. They run through the tunnels but are trapped by the Keramech and its soldiers. The Sai Ruvi leader orders its soldiers to grab our heroes, when suddenly, the Puek bodyguards turn and fire, killing the Keramech. It's a revolution, a signal to the other Puek to turn against their Sai Ruvi masters and take the planet back for the Bakurans. The Solos transport Tahiri to the medical bay on the Solonia. Gore says the young Jedi is lost within her own mind. They're told that she must reconcile both parts of herself if she's going to survive.
The story ends on Yu-Jon-Tar. Shimra meets with his top advisors to discuss the growing religion spreading through the Shamed Ones, and Namor has a front row seat. The former executor watches Shimra from a villip hidden deep inside N'Gala's cloak. The Supreme Overlord is angry. He turns to High Priest Jaqen and demands to know what he's doing to quash the heresy. But it's not just among the lower castes, Jaqen says. It's also growing among the warriors and the intendants. N'Gala volunteers to lead the investigation into the heresy, promising to root it out. Shimra dismisses the court in disgust, much to the delight of Namor.
Time for a break. When we return, Kat and I will talk more about Force Heretic 2, Refugee, by Sean Williams and Shane Dix. I'm Aaron Motes. Stay tuned. You're listening to the Star Wars Legends Lounge. Thank you for listening to the Star Wars Legends Lounge, where we celebrate the books from Star Wars Legends. But let me take a moment and recommend a book from Star Wars canon. Aftermath: Empire's End is the conclusion to the best-selling trilogy about the final days of the Empire. Nora Wexley and her team hunt for Imperial Grand Admiral Rey Sloane, who's searching for the mysterious Gallius Rex. And it all culminates at one last battle on the planet Jakku. Will Nora and Rey Sloane be able to stop Rex from implementing the Emperor's final plan? Find out in Aftermath: Empire's End by Chuck Wendig, the final book in the Aftermath trilogy. Welcome back to the Star Wars Legends Lounge, the show that celebrates the books from Star Wars Legends. I'm Aaron Motes, and today, Kat and I are talking about Force Heretic 2, Refugee, by Sean Williams and Shane Dix, the 16th book in the New Jedi Order series. Now, much like the first Force Heretic book, this book is divided among three main storylines. You have Luke and Jason searching for Zanama Seacot, Leia, Han, and Jaina again trying to bring the outskirts of the galaxy back under the Galactic Alliance. And then you have Namor and the Jedi heresy on Yuuzhan Tarr. The first book is a really fast-paced adventure. Some of that continues in this one, but I would say that there are parts of this book that slow down and let the reader take a breath. Kat, what did you think about the pacing of this story as compared to the pacing of the first book in the Force Heretic stories?
I would also agree. I think that in the first book, they had to do a lot of setup as, like, these are the directions we're sending our characters in, and these are the motivations behind those. And now in the second book, we get to breathe a little bit. We get to kind of sit with them in their missions. They talk more about the philosophy and the decisions behind why they're doing these missions a little bit. So I think the first book is where are we going, and how are we going to get there? The second book is, why are we doing this? Why are we picking these missions in particular? And I really like that. I think they handled it really well.
Which of the three plot lines is the most interesting to you?
Definitely, I'd say the Bakurin plotline, just because we get a lot of different layers in that plotline. We're following Jaina as she talks to Malenza. And then we're also following Tahiri and Gore. And then we also get a little bit between Leia, Han, and the Prime Minister. So we get a couple of different storylines even within their particular story. So I think that we get a lot of different philosophies of why they're trying to do certain things. I'm pretty interested in that. Not that I didn't love that they had to go to the Chiss planet and read books, because I'm all for anybody reading books in a book. It's just fun for me. So
what's interesting to me about the Bakurin plotline is it's one of the few times we see Jaina not just jumping into battle as her reflex on how to handle a situation. She has to negotiate, or at least help her mother negotiate with the Bakurin government. She also goes to question Malenza Tanis in prison. And she has some compassion for Malenza. She tries to see the young girl's point of view when it comes to what they want for the planet. For me, it's a nice change of pace for Jaina. I've said Jaina is one of my favorite characters in Legends, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that she's always gung-ho, ready to jump right into the action, whether it be in her X-Wing or whether it be with her lightsaber. But it is nice to see that there are layers to Jaina Solo.
Yeah, I definitely agree. Especially the conversation that she has with Malenza when she's talking about a different kind of balance. It's not the Force per se, but it involves the Force. It's definitely like a galactic kind of balancing point where something bad is going to happen here, then something good has to happen there. It's a give and take.
If you picture scales, that's what the main religion of Bakura basically is.
Yeah, and Jaina definitely has some good points that it's related to the Force. It's not the same thing, but she understands where Malenza is coming from and that their people just want to be able to exist how they want to be able to exist. But she doesn't speak for every person. She speaks for like 5 or 6 people who are in this freedom with her. It's not the whole planet or anything. So having her have that conversation is really important. Like you said, it just gives Jaina that breathing room that she can't just act first, think later. She's kind of, like you said, being a diplomat. We saw that with Jason in the first book. He was being the diplomat, and now we get to see Jaina put on that hat. So they give these characters even more depth.
So one of the things you get with the Bakuran storyline is a continuation of Tahiri mentally fighting with herself. She doesn't black out all the time like she does in the first book, but she's trying to run from Rhaena, the Yuuzhan Vong part of her. When she tries to stop the bomb at the end, Jaina hears over the comlink Tahiri yelling in the Yuuzhan Vong language right before it explodes. Later, when Gore, the Rin, is talking about how Tahiri has to figure out a way to live with both halves of her, his theory is that Tahiri was so distraught over Anakin's death that she was willing to sacrifice herself to save Jaina, Leia, and Han. But Rhaena refused to die. And his theory is that Rhaena is the one who saved Tahiri. What do you think of the way this storyline is progressing? And what do you think will happen in the third book when it comes to Tahiri and Rhaena?
I see a lot of hope in this character. I have always really, really loved Tahiri's character. She was able to come back from the brink, but she also, whenever she was with the Vong, she never lost herself completely. And so her storyline shows, I think, the hope for the end of the series overall, that she represents the Jedi and the Vong being able to reconcile and come together to a certain extent. Their ideologies might look different, but in practice, they can go for the same goal. Tahiri wanted to save people, and therefore she wanted to try and stop the bomb. But at the end of the day, she was more distraught and ready to take her own life versus killing as many people as possible. And Rhaena wanted the same thing. She wanted preservation at the end of the day, which involved saving a lot of people, including Tahiri. So they might come from the goal at different points, but they can come to the same goal.
One last thing on the Bakura plotline before we move to one of the others. Those that have read The Truce of Bakura know a little about the story. This planet is continually threatened by an alien race called the Syruk. However, the authors turn it on its head a little at the very, very, very end. And it turns out that at least some of the Syruk who pit these two factions against each other again are actually Yuuzhan Vong wearing those Ooglith maskers. Did that surprise you at the end?
Yeah, my mind was blown. That was... I was not expecting that because, A, their philosophy is definitely a new one for me, where they basically take souls and put them into machines and use them as slaves. And so they're working kind of through Kundertol, who is also a machine with this synth skin over him, in the same way. So to see these Vong working with machine slaves, that was a big surprise. And just to see them at the end, at all, to see them kind of out and about out there, and we hadn't heard Shimra or anybody mention anything about a secondary third plot going on way out in these boony regions. So I was very surprised.
So let's head over to our other group of heroes led by Luke and Jason. Why is Jason so drawn to this legend of Zonama Sikot, and why is he so convinced that this living planet exists and will be able to help them in the war with the Yuuzhan Vong?
Yeah, I'd love to hear your answer on this, because I can only think of, like, obviously he always references Vajir. Like, Vajir puts so much emphasis on this planet. She spent a very long time on this planet before. So clearly this planet meant a lot to Vajir. And Vajir, whether Jason liked it or not, meant an immense amount to him. And so her importance becomes his importance. Is it her mission? Is it something that he doesn't know why he's so obsessed with it? He's just kind of going for it? Or I'm definitely curious to see what you think.
The first time I read this, before I knew what happened, I think my working theory was Jason has been obsessed with trying to find another way to solve this conflict that did not involve violence. And Vajir told him the story of how she was on Zonama Sikot when the Far Outsiders, the Yuuzhan Vong, a scouting party, arrived there, and the planet itself was able to fend them off, but without killing them. I think Jason is obsessed with trying to figure out how Zonama Sikot did that, and if the Jedi would be able to replicate that with the large force that the Yuuzhan Vong now have in the galaxy. That's why I think he so desperately wants to find it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And it also, I think it makes a lot of sense for his character, because like you said, he's been looking for a more peaceful method this whole time. But it also still rings true for Jason, who is still very clearly an obsessed individual overall. He's either obsessed with, like, internally thinking about absolutely everything, every decision that every Jedi has ever made. And so this is just the new obsession that he has. He really wants to make sure that he can find a peaceful solution for this. He's been in and around the Yuuzhan Vong more than most, probably Tahiri being the most, but he's been able to see them and sympathizes with some of them and definitely wants to get to that answer. So that makes a lot of sense, especially, like I said, with his obsession on dialing into that method.
So in the first book of the series, we got a possible budding romance between Jason and Danny. In this book, we get a little bit more, but unlike Jaina and Jag, these two don't really flirt, in my opinion. They more just come right out and start having deep conversations. On some level, I think they're both still trying to come up with reasons why maybe we should give this a chance, or, nah, this isn't really a good idea, maybe we shouldn't. What are your thoughts so far on Danny and Jason?
It rings true for both of their characters, because they're both big thinkers. So they gotta overthink absolutely everything. So they're really just teasing the audience to no end, and it hurts my soul, but that's okay. Like I said, it also rings true for these characters, which makes me really happy. They are overly talking through the situation, because whenever they first met, it was not a weird age difference, but just enough to be slightly uncomfortable. So it was just on the cusp of, this could be a little bit weird, maybe not now. But now that they have been in and around each other and they've kind of matured in front of each other, they're like, okay, these feelings still have not gone away. So we probably owe it to each other to at least talk through this a bit more. And Danny's doing a great job of that. Jason is a little bit more singularly focused, which, again, is part of his character, is fine. But Danny gives this amazing speech, And she's like, at the end, you know, you don't have to answer anything. He's like, cool, great, I'm not. Let's go find that planet. And I'm like, thanks, Jason. You really just broke my heart, but that's fine.
Yeah, I will say the maturity of Jason specifically is nice because, you know, obviously when he first found Danny attractive, he was rescuing her, and he was a 16-year-old who basically had a crush on this smart, pretty 20-year-old. I don't think Danny had any reciprocal feelings for Jason at that time. I think it's now that Jason has come back from what, 6 to 8 months of being a captive of the Yuuzhan Vong. As I said, he's more mature, he's more focused. On some level, he's more at peace with himself. They can have more of these grown-up conversations. But when I read these conversations, to me, they read as, we could try this, but I'm not really sure this is a good idea. I'm not sure we would be good together.
Yeah, it's definitely a will they, won't they kind of relationship of, again, they're overthinking
I mean, it's not even a relationship yet. They're
it.
just talking to each other.
Yeah, exactly. Part of me thinks they would be good together, but part of me also worries because they are so intellectual, that they might not be able to read into each other's emotions as well, or I don't know. It's a very, like you said, it's very different from Jaina and Jag, and I like that. I like that we're getting not just the more passionate, we have to do something about this now, and Jaina and Jag are kind of opposites. Their Jaina and, or I'm sorry, Jason and Danny's potential relationship is a totally different type of relationship. And so I think it's interesting. I like to see it grow. It's just a very slow burn.
Do you have any thoughts about Zenama Seacott?
Gosh, it is just such a mystery. I know that, like, having Luke and Mara and Sabah and Jason and Danny all on this mission to find this planet, it's gonna be something crazy. It's gonna be great if and when they find it. I'm hoping it's gonna be, like, I just don't know, is it an alive planet? So in to totally left-hand field, there's a planet in DC Comics that's alive, and it is a Green Lantern. So that's what I'm picturing for this planet. It doesn't talk, but you're able to figure out its will through different means. It's able to communicate through nature, plants, vines. So that's what I'm picturing for Zenama Seacott in particular. How they are going to react with it, how it's going to help them. That is just, I'm really excited to find out what is about to, because they've been leading up to this, and I'm hoping it's going to be the solution that Jason wants it to be.
One quick question on the last storyline, the heresy on Yuuzhan Tarr. Namor has stepped up now to a new level. The heresy has risen through the ranks and has gotten to one of, at least one of, the members of an upper caste, a priestess, who is now helping Namor spy on Shimra and Shimra's top officers within the Yuuzhan Vong. What do you think of this storyline right now?
I'm very happy with this turn that it's taken. I think that we've kind of been seeing little eggs here and there of some of the Vong are not. They first presented as we are one front, we all believe the same thing, we all believe in the same gods, this is our mission. But now we're seeing the intricacies of any society of There are a lot of differences between castes and between individuals that they don't all see the mission as the only mission. So this difference of opinions in Namor kind of latching on to these ideas and spearheading it into one mission, I think works with the Vong, and it's definitely going to create a lot of problems for Shim-Ra, but I think it's also going to create a ton of problems for Namor. I'm not sure at the end of this that he's going to be like, joke, just kidding. Like, I have to kill all of you who are true believers, and I have to kill some non-believers. Like, I'm definitely interested to see what Namor ends up at the very end. Is he like, again, he doesn't like the Jedi from as everything that we actually get to see in his mind. He does not believe in this Jedi. Like, this is a total farce. But his followers do believe this. Are they going to turn on him? Are they going to listen to him when he's like, yeah, none of that stuff really happened, so we'll just create our own mission? Like, not really sure where he's going to be able to take that train. He's latched himself to this raging bull and not sure he's going to be able to direct it by the end of this. So.
But he does now have a spy in Shimra's court.
Yeah, definitely. And I definitely think at the end of this, Namor is going to be the main player. I just don't know what then is going to happen when Shim-Ra is gone, whenever some of the other powerful players are gone, and it's just him at the top. I don't know how what that looks like. I just don't believe in his over. I believe in him as a spy. I don't believe in him as a leader.
Well, Kat, it's almost time to go, but first I'd like to read an email from one of our listeners, Matt, who disagrees with a couple things that I said about the Heir to the Empire trilogy. Matt writes, "In Heir to the Empire, you mention Mara Jade did not pay restitution for her history of being the Emperor's hand. During the trilogy of novels, she is paying her restitution, as she comes full circle with what she'd been doing, and it releases her from the grip of the Emperor when she ends the clone Luke and the clone Sabaoth. In Dark Force Rising, you say that no one knows of Garm Bel Iblis's rebel cell. I think they could have known, since in canon, in Rebels, they show other cells, but not who leads them all the time. So maybe they knew of it, but Iblis's name was never connected to it. Finally, in The Last Command, you complained about the fact that Sabaoth made the clone Luke from the hand Luke lost on Bespin, and that he had Anakin's lightsaber. I would like to suggest that maybe the Emperor had recovered the hand and lightsaber and had stored it at Mount Tantiss with express intent of cloning Luke had he killed Vader and Luke during Return of the Jedi. Sabaoth knew the hand was there and was shown how to use the cloning cylinders by Grand Admiral Thrawn." Well, thank you very much for the email, Matt. I like your opinions. If those things that don't quite work for me work for you, great. I've accepted the fact that I'll just never be a fan of how Anakin's lightsaber wasn't simply lost at Cloud City, and how it continued on in both canon and legends. But in all honesty, I'm probably just being a little nitpicky. Thank you very much for the email, Matt. Now, listener, if I say something on the show that you disagree with, let me know. I'll give you the floor. Email me at swlegendslounge@gmail.com or send me a tweet at legendslounge1. Kat, thank you very much for joining me today.
I had so much fun, and I'm excited that we're getting towards the end, and can't wait for us hopefully all to be able to get together and gush over this fantastic series.
Now, if the listeners would like to contact you, or if they'd like to listen to Animated Antics, how can they do that?
So the Animated Antics podcast is up on Spotify, Google, a couple of different other ones. So check that out. We are on Instagram, Twitter, Blue Sky. Just search for Animated Antics, Animated Antics Pod. On Twitter, we're at JaneCat1. If you wanted to find me directly, I am DelanceyCat. That's DelanceyCat, DelanceyCat on Twitter. But we'd love to talk about anything animated with you. Like I said, the next thing we're covering is going to be Clone Wars Season 1 from 2008. So pretty excited to talk about that next.
Coming up on the next episode, Jay will join me to talk about the final book in this trilogy, Force Heretic 3 Reunion by Shane Dix and Sean Williams. You can look forward to that episode coming out on November 24th. Thank you so much for listening to the Star Wars Legends Lounge. I'm Aaron Motes. May the Force be with you. And remember, there's always a bit of truth in legends.